From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A whopping 18 Democrats are running for president in 2020, but as of this week, the Republican field has just doubled to two. Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld announced his primary challenge to President Trump on CNN's The Lead with Jake Tapper Monday.
I really think if we have six more years of the same stuff we've had out of the White House the last 2 years, that would be a political tragedy, and I would fear for the Republic. So I would be ashamed of myself if I didn't raise my hand and run.
The Trump campaign has come out swinging in anticipation of just such a challenge. Trump campaigners have deployed an effort to influence and at times dictate the electoral machinery of the Republican Party on the state level. We'll speak to Bill Weld about his run and take a deep look at Trump's efforts nationwide to head off primary challenges. This hour on Point, Bill Weld, the Republican and Trump campaigns and the roadblock to the GOP primaries. Join us for our Republican listeners. How loyal are you to President Trump? How open would you be to a Republican challenger? And for all listeners, what questions do you have for Bill Weld? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will be talking with Bill Weld a bit later this hour. We are joined here in studio with James Pindill. He's the political reporter for the Boston Globe, political analyst for our originating station WBUR here in Boston, where I happen to be here today, former political director for WMUR, the ABC affiliate in Manchester, New Hampshire. That is a lot of the alphabet to go over. You can link to James's reportings at our website, onpointradio.org. James Pindill, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the state of play in the Republican race, obviously. Why does it matter to presidents, by and large, incumbents, to make sure that they don't have too many challengers?
Well, history will tell the story here. Since 1968, every incumbent president who faced a serious primary challenge was not reelected. LBJ, of course, won the New Hampshire primary, but it was an underwhelming win. It was 60%. And then after that, 2 weeks after that, we remember his famous phrase that he would not seek nor would he accept the nomination, and he dropped out of the race. And then you can go through every single time after that. Jerry Ford, of course, getting a primary challenge from Ronald Reagan in 1976. He does not win re-election. Jimmy Carter getting a primary challenge from Ted Kennedy in 1980. He does not win re-election. And then, of course, the last time this happened, 1992, and when George H.W. Bush gets a primary challenge from Pat Buchanan, and he, of course, does not win re-election. So every president since then has really kind of focused early on how do they ensure that they are at least in a strong position within their own party? How do they use their own power of incumbency? Worried about the historical precedent. Yet here we are. We are now a little over, obviously a year away from the presidential race, but it's clearly happening because we're 10 months away from the New Hampshire primary. And Donald Trump is the first person since George H.W. Bush 18 years ago to face a primary challenge. And now the question is, where do things stand? And we can talk a little bit more about, structurally speaking, what Trump has tried to do to head off Bill Weld.
Well, and let's talk to the man of the moment himself. With us from Manchester, New Hampshire, is the 2020 Republican presidential candidate, Bill Weld. He was a top justice official under President Reagan, was governor of Massachusetts from 1991 to 1997. This isn't his first bid for national office. Just 3 years ago, Weld was the vice presidential nominee on the Libertarian Party ticket. He's also been a lobbyist and a novelist. Governor Weld, welcome to On Point.
David, good to be with you. Thank you.
A puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn, and a king. You've held a lot of jobs over the years. Tell us a little bit about what the first 100 to 150 days of the Bill Weld administration would look like.
Well, the first thing I would do would be to cut spending, which has not been done. And basically, Congress and the president together are spending us toward bankruptcy. People think that can't happen. But, you know, when I came into office in Massachusetts, the outgoing Secretary of Administration Finance that January said the state is bankrupt. It can't pay its bills. And, you know, if the Chinese stop buying our treasury bills and we keep piling on $1 trillion a year of debt, we won't be able to pay those bills either. I don't think people realize the seriousness of that, but we do need an economic conservative in Washington to kind of change the drift. After you cut spending, then you can have more tax cuts, and I think that helps the economy, but you have to cut spending first. That's probably the number one thing in point of time. Number two, I do think that this president, Mr. Trump, has made a habit of insulting our military allies. Matter of fact, I know it. and praising dictators and autocrats and trying to move people like Viktor Orban in Hungary, who's a nationalist like Mr. Trump, meaning he hates other countries, trying to move Hungary out of the Western orbit into the Soviet orbit. The president has questioned the efficacy and even utility of NATO, which is our sort of shield against Russia to its east. And nobody except Vladimir Putin could want that kind of approach to be taken in foreign relations. So there would be a sharp turn there if I get my hands on the levers, so to speak. And I really think the president is undercutting our national security and strategic position with those twin moves of cozying up to dictators and really insulting our military allies. And that's true both in Europe and in Asia.
You know, I want to ask you a quick series of,
sure.
We do a little lightning round with presidential candidates as they come through on point.
Sure.
You mentioned, let's start with tax policy very quickly. You mentioned that you'd like to get to some additional tax cuts after you've been able to achieve what you say would be some significant budget cuts. Would you want to keep the current tax policies in place that the president was able to pass with Congress recently?
Listen, I never met a tax cut I didn't like, and I cut taxes 21 times. I think probably the first taxes I would go on to cut would be to further lower the capital gains tax, because I think that's very good for the economy. It influences investment decisions, and when people decide to invest, that has a spillover effect on the employment rate. So I would go there. I also, and this is just a pet peeve of mine, but I think the death tax, the federal death tax, almost amounts to double taxation, and it penalizes people for a lifetime of work. Those are not terribly expensive tax cuts, so they'd be a good place to start as opposed to further cutting taxes like the income tax of general application, because that would be very, very expensive.
Sure.
Down the line, I might want to take a look at flattening the income tax side of things. In the past, I've considered favorably the proposals by Steve Forbes and others to try to cut the income tax to, say, 19-20%. And you need to do all the arithmetic to see that that would still be able to pay for everything we need to pay for. But I think I've read both of Steve Forbes' book on the topic, and I think probably it could. But that would be not something that I would propose right now as a proposal, but it's something I would certainly look into.
Sure. And just to make sure that listeners recall, death tax is often what's called the estate tax. I want to run through a couple other quick things with you. The president's stance on current administration's stance on immigration, sanctuary cities, and the like. How do you feel about those?
I think the president's stance on immigration is nothing short of shameful. It's political sloganeering and grandstanding. And the president says he's a nationalist. Well, what he really means is he wants to stir up everybody into a state of great anger against other nations. A nationalist is someone for whom hatred of other nations is the touchstone. A patriot is someone for whom love of your own country and your own people is the touchstone. So I'm totally on the other side from Mr. Trump as a moral matter there. We've been a melting pot our whole history in the United States, and anyone who wants to undo that is really, truly spitting into the wind. And that's the moral matter and historical matter. Beyond that, there's the economic matter. And we need more work visas to get the business of our agricultural industry and our construction industry done, particularly in the western part of the states. You ask any state governor west of Texas, if they can get all the work done without the flow of migrants from the south over the Mexican border. And that's not just Mexico. That's everybody to the south. But they get the work done or contribute to getting the work done in the construction and agricultural industries during their seasons in those western states in particular. So I think the president's stance on immigration is purely polemical, not rooted in fact at all, and I'd be 180 degrees on the other side of that policy.
Obviously, Governor, we're not going to know what the redacted Mueller report at least has to say until tomorrow. And by the same token, your former top Justice Department official, your former top federal prosecutor. How would you characterize what we've learned so far about the behavior of the president and those around him?
I think it's relatively speaking a non-event. I mean, Bob Mueller is one of the most thorough prosecutors I've ever met. And one thing we made an art form of when we were prosecutors together is negativing all avenues of escape. And if he didn't come up with any evidence of collusion between the president and his people and the Russians, then it wasn't there. I'm telling you, I think the release of the full report, first of all, I think the whole report should be released. Second, I would have some concern that to the extent that there's life in it, the life will have been squeezed out by the time the redacted report is released. But in any event, I think it's going to be a non-event.
Mm-hmm. And briefly, we only have about a minute left, but tell me a little bit about climate change is an issue for you. President Trump has cast doubt on the reality of it, and the administration has been skeptical of it policy-wise. Where would a Bill Weld administration stand?
Well, again, I think the president's being irresponsible. He's got a one-word platform for global warming, which is hoax. Does he think all those scientists who took those measurements are falsifying the measurements because they're going to make money on the deal? I mean, maybe he can't conceive of anything else than they must have an angle to make money on the deal. But it's ludicrous. We're past the point of being able to dispute the science. So I would rejoin the Paris Accords. I think we have to adopt 2050 CO2 targets that are for release that are consistent with what other industrialized countries have done. You know, the president gets a lot of credit for, quote, deregulating. If you look at what he's deregulated, a great many of those regulations are the regulations designed to protect clean air and clean water.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the president has sided with the fossil fuel industry against clean air and clean water for all Americans. And I hate to say it, but I again think he's been completely irresponsible.
Well, stick with us, Governor Bill Weld. We're discussing his run against President Donald Trump in the 2020 election. We want you to join our conversation. If you're particularly a Republican or vote in GOP primaries, how receptive are you to a challenger to the president? What questions do you have for former Governor Bill Weld? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a look at Republican Bill Weld's run for president and the Trump campaign's efforts to stave off Republican opposition. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for former Governor Bill Weld, who's with us today? What activities do you see by the president's campaign in your state? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Governor, we have a few several listeners calling in to ask you a couple of questions. Before we go to them, I had one quick other question for you. Have you talked about this at all with Senator Mitt Romney? The former presidential nominee, he has obviously spoken in public and written about his concerns about the presidency of Mr. Trump.
I haven't spoken to Mitt recently, but I have in the past. And, you know, I think he shares some of my views that I've just expressed. He's a little bit more muted in how he how he couches them. But I think we're in the, you know, we're in the same church, even if it's not the same pew.
Did he encourage you to think about this?
He's not discouraging, let me put it that way. I've also had nice conversations much more recently with former Ohio Governor John Kasich and current Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. And they're, you know, they're supportive as far as the conversations have gone. They're not saying, oh, don't do this or wait for me. Or, you know, they kind of do agree. I think both those governors, that someone's got to raise their hand, and this has to start somewhere. And it so happens that it's starting with me because I can do it, and I want to do it, and I'm doing it. I wouldn't drop dead with surprise if the field broadens and expands, and if other people get in as well. I think that might be good for the Republican Party and good for the country to have a real array of views represented on the Republican side and not just the 15 or 20 views on the Democratic side.
We're going to take a couple of callers now and see what questions they have for you, Governor. Sure. David is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. David, go ahead.
Yes. Hello, David. I enjoy the show as always.
Thanks.
And I've always been a great fan and a supporter of Governor Weld. Governor, I've followed your career through the years.
Sure.
I'd like to ask you, sir, you've already mentioned, and I very much agree with you, that about how you would restore relations in a world presidency with some of our European allies. But I'd also like to ask you, what would a world campaign and a world presidency do in its first 100 days in office to restore civility here in America, to reset the tone in politics generally? And I'd also like to ask you quickly, if I were serious about joining your campaign, what would I do? Who would I reach out to in order to do that?
On the last question, and thank you very much, the last question, the website is Weld2020, WELD2020.org. You should be able to find everything you need there, including how to contribute money, but other stuff too.
Well, and contributing civility. What about that, Governor?
Yeah, no, that's the more important question. I think that's a tone set from the Oval Office, right from the top. A fish rots from the head, and civility has to spring from the head. The president, of course, is famous for being mean-spirited and disruptive and divisive and wanting anything but civility. He calculates that it suits his political instincts to have everybody's teeth on edge, everybody looking around to see who's the newest group that they can hate and fear. And it's just not the politics I was brought up with, and I don't think it's good for the United States. In office, constantly reached across the aisle. I set up a weekly luncheon with the Democratic leadership and the legislature and myself and my great Lieutenant Governor Paul Cellucci. And we met every Monday for two terms, and it worked out so well that everyone since then, including Governor Mitt Romney, has followed the practice. And it's done to this day by my cabinet member Charlie Baker, who's now the sitting governor in Massachusetts. So mm-hmm. Massachusetts and most other state capitals, not all, but most, have that tradition of civility between the parties and specifically between the executive branch and the legislature. And we made that almost an art form in Massachusetts. And you get so much more done that way, so much more done. If you have a civil meeting with somebody once a week on a regular basis, it's just harder to stab them in the back or tell the press that they're an enormous jerk because it's inconsistent with your course of dealing with them. So that's what I would do.
Governor, I want to take another call now from Wausau, Wisconsin. Dave, go ahead. What's your question for the governor?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like to ask Mr. Weld here exactly why the Republicans should trust you this time. As said, in 2016, you were the Libertarian vice presidential candidate. While you were in Wisconsin, at least, you were asked which senator you could see yourself working with, and you called out Feingold, who was running against Ron Johnson, and even though you had a Libertarian candidate on the same ballot, and then openly advocated people voting for Hillary while vice presidential nominee for the Libertarians over the Republican ticket. I'm just curious as why Republicans should trust you this time.
You know, I took a lot of heat for saying nice things about Russ Feingold, and I guess I didn't know at that point, I was still green, that a Libertarian was running against him. I've known him a long time since he was in law school. I think he's a very intelligent guy and a person of quality, not taking anything away from Senator Johnson or any other candidate. I just happened to mention him. In terms of Mrs. Clinton, no, I never did urge people to vote for her, but I thought she was taking such a shellacking for being dishonest at the end of the campaign, and nobody was sticking up for her at all. And I've known her since I worked on the House Watergate committee with her back in the 1970s. We were both children. Let me put it this way. I do not think she's a crook, and I thought that the president's successful campaign against her, lock her up, she's a crook, I didn't agree with that. So what I did say on television is I'm here to vouch for her personally. That didn't mean everyone should vote for her, but it meant I was vouching for her. I think my exact words were, it'd be nice for someone other than Donna Brazel and the members of the Democratic National Committee to say something even neutral about Mrs. Clinton. So that's what that one was all about.
And obviously in the years since, you've been quite critical of the man who defeated her, President Trump. Governor Bill Weld, I want to ask you one last question before we let you go. We know you've been basically been on the stump in your new candidacy in New Hampshire, as well as reaching out elsewhere. It seems to me that since you last held elective office, the party has changed a lot under you. What would you say to those who would argue that you may not reflect the Republican Party as it now exists compared to perhaps how it was when you were last in elected office?
Well, I think it's changed a lot under Mr. Trump, and I would not reflect Mr. Trump, and he would not reflect me. We are two large orange men who, other than that, have nothing in common, absolutely nothing in common politically, except maybe cutting taxes. I don't think the party changed that much before Mr. Trump got there. It's quite true that he seems to have captivated everybody in Washington. They're all keeping their mouths shut and not making any noise. They don't want to rock the boat. I don't understand that. I know a bunch of those people, and they're great. They're great people, and they're good public servants. But suddenly someone has sewn their lips shut, and no one is saying the emperor doesn't have any new clothes. I think the emperor is absolutely naked as a jaybird and does not have any new clothes. And as you can tell, while trying to be respectful of the office, I just don't have any patience for his foolery and his consistent narcissism. Look at me, look at me. It's all about me. I think the way Mr. Trump looks at the world, it really is all about two things. One, himself, and two, the Trump Organization and its business success. That's not putting the people first.
Former Governor Bill Weld of Massachusetts, newly announced Republican candidate for president, one of two large orange men with nothing else in common. Bill Weld, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, David.
Joining us now once more in studio, James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe, political analyst for us here at WBUR. You heard what former Governor Bill Weld had to say. He's a person of stature. You know, he's held significant roles in American public life. What do you make of his appeal and of what he had to say today?
What's interesting about this particular primary challenge, as opposed to the ones we've talked about in history, is that those primary challenges in history typically have come from the party's base, either from the left, if a Democratic challenge of a Democratic president, or from the right, say the last time with Pat Buchanan, really upset about the no new taxes pledge or the cultural war element. This time, you heard some mix here, right? I mean, he doubles down saying that he wants even more tax cuts. He's the real conservative. He wants to cut spending. So from that side, he's going to come from the right. But what he will be most associated with is being a never Trumper, to use the phrase, for his positions, say, on climate change and the environment, for his positions where he's long been there to be very socially liberal. You know, one thing that is true, and he said this repeatedly since he's announced, is that, yes, he did run as the libertarian nominee for vice president in 2016, but he didn't really change any single political position he has held. And so that's
the same guy.
He's the same guy. So a libertarian in a Republican race is interesting. It's got, you know, in terms of the base and then the liberal side, but he will be coming at this from more of the moderate, never Trumper wing. And we've never really seen someone challenge an incumbent president like that in modern times in a very successful way.
I mean, I was thinking in my head when you were talking about this, Ronald Reagan challenged Gerald Ford mm-hmm. from the right in 76. It helped to damage Ford, although he may have been damaged anyway. President Jimmy Carter was challenged by Ronald Reagan from the right. You know, you mentioned at the top of the hour, you know, you said, look, anytime you faced a major challenge, it has basically damaged the incumbent. But it seems to me we're almost retroactively thinking about what constitutes a major challenge. Pete McCloskey was a congressman from the Midwest who challenged Richard Nixon in 72, was kind of wiped off the map. But Pat Buchanan, who had never held elective office, who was probably known before his things from appearing a bit on syndicated TV shows, in cable in 1992, he'd been, I guess, communications director for Reagan and a speechwriter for Nixon. You know, he achieved an incredible thing in New Hampshire in 92, and that proved to be incredibly undermining for President George H.W. Bush, although Buchanan had no path to anything, really.
Right. And so now that we're taking it to the next step, I mean, if you talk to a lot of Trump campaign officials and aides, they are heavily studying what happened in 1992, and they're trying to head off what happened, which was a kind of a really messy convention. So they have been really ingraining themselves in trying to prevent any type of challenge. That has gone to a very granular level where they are now very much involved in electing state chairs, in trying to figure out how delegates are elected to the convention. I mean, you can talk about 1992 where, you know, George H.W. Bush had to, you know, throw a bone to the Buchanan supporters and let Buchanan give this famous speech about the culture wars, which, you know, really was really successful inside the convention hall, but really not successful outside of the convention hall, and really probably, you know, obviously derailed the message of the Republican convention. Or they can just look at what happened in 2016 during Donald Trump's own convention, when there were lots of people kind of led by the Never Trumpers using Ted Cruz as that vehicle to create some serious questions about, you know, is there party infighting? Is the party behind them? So the Trump campaign has done a number of things. One of them, which is an unprecedented move, which is to take over the Republican National Committee, which is something that Bill Weld will have to contend with. He jokes about it. I asked him about it yesterday in New Hampshire. He relishes the idea that he's not just running against one state party, but all of them and the RNC officially. There are serious questions whether the RNC can actually spend money in the primary on behalf of President Trump. But that's where we're at right now. And that's what Bill Weld will be going up against.
So let's talk a little bit about the macro level and the granularity. First, the macro level. At the Conservative Political Action Conference in February, Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel warned potential Republican primary challengers against entering the 2020 presidential election. Here's what she had to say.
Well, they have the right to jump in and lose. That's fine. They will lose horribly. I mean, the president has 93% approval in our party. Our country is booming. What would any Republican be thinking, saying, this is a guy I'm going to run against? So have at it. Go ahead. Waste your money. Waste your time. And go ahead and lose.
And Ronna McDaniel, it's worth pointing out, I think in some ways dropped her maiden name, which is Romney. That is, she was the niece of Senator Mitt Romney, a frequent Trump critic, at the behest, essentially, of the White House and the president. Why do you say it's unprecedented for the RNC? Don't parties always work closely with the president?
You know, we're now talking about the technical level. Typically, what happens is the National Party works in tandem with an incumbent president. The incumbent president obviously will name the chairperson, as Donald Trump has with Ronna McDaniel. But they never actually take over the National Party, which is actually officially what has already happened. And so you saw even this week joint fundraising numbers from the RNC and the Trump campaign as if they were one single entity. So structurally speaking, it's very difficult for anyone to have any particular primary challenge. And look, there was even conversation in January about whether the RNC should even sanction and allow for primary elections to happen state by state, or whether they should just fully back
snuff it out
the president from day one. That's right.
That's kind of amazing. I talked.
It's not happening, but that was where we got in the conversation.
And the idea in the past, I assume, just quickly, is that the party, even in years where there was president, felt it had to be something of an arbiter in case other candidates came along and ran? Or is it just that there needed to be some legal distinctions?
Well, there's both the legal distinction for some of them. Now, granted, they're private parties. They can have their own rules. But also as an insurance check, we're expecting the Mueller report to come out tomorrow. Not quite sure exactly what the political fallout would be. But, you know, when we're having this conversation in January, when Republicans are talking about it, part of the pushback was, hey, guys, do we really want to go completely all in, or do we want to have a nominee who might be somebody else? So that's part of the conversation.
And on state level, I interviewed for a little bit yesterday the chairman of the Republican Party of Iowa, that's Jeff Kaufman. He told us that he's remaining neutral in the Republican parties and yet will still support the president and his policies. Here's how he tried to make that decision. Distinction.
I believe the president wants to make sure that we are fair. I think the president wants to make sure that we have his back if he is attacked, and those attacks can come from the left wing of the Democratic Party, or they could possibly come from some Never Trumpers. Either way, I'm going to be there to stand up for the president in his duties as president of the United States. But we are going to have our caucuses here. I feel we need to do that for the integrity of that entire process.
I think it's fair also to say that Kaufman made sure that after the caucuses take place, that there's no way for other possible candidacies to come in and try to rig the actual convention of the state to try to do a rearguard action, as Ted Cruz attempted to do in 2016. We're here with James Pindle. He's a political reporter for Boston Globe, analyst for us here at WBUR, our NPR station in Boston. We're discussing the Trump campaign's efforts to garner support in state Republican parties and to prevent primary challengers. You can join our conversation. How welcoming should state Republican parties be to challengers to a sitting president? How loyal should they be? How willing are you to consider voting for a challenger? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a look at the Trump campaign's state-level efforts to prevent a primary challenge within the Republican Party. You can join our conversation. What actions and activities have you seen by the Trump campaign in your state? What campaign messages resonate with you? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking in studio with James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe, political analyst for WBUR Radio. Joining us now from Columbia, South Carolina is Matt Moore. He's partner at the political and grassroots strategy firm First Tuesday Strategies. He served as chairman of the South Carolina Republican Party from 2013 to 2017. Matt, welcome to On Point.
It's good to be here.
Appreciate it. So, Matt, there was some talk, if I remember, at the opening of the year about whether or not South Carolina should have a primary at all. Sketch for us a little bit sort of at that moment, the thinking in the party, why that was raised and how that result, how that played out.
Well, South Carolina's primary is unique for a couple of reasons. One, it's in-state law that basically the parties offload the cost of running the actual primary to taxpayers. Therefore, it requires a request to the legislature far before any actual primary takes place. It's about $2 million per party for each primary. So the party here, I think, was sort of anecdotally weighing the cost versus the benefit. And of course, that story took on a life of its own and garnered a lot of national press. But South Carolina's primary is different than New Hampshire's, additionally because of the high filing fee. Last time around in 2016, the candidates paid about $40,000 to enter the South Carolina Republican primary versus a very low fee in New Hampshire, right? So it's a little bit higher of a bar legally and practically to get on the South Carolina ballot.
How active has the president's men and women been in trying to influence how the party shapes things for the primary season, for the convention in the state, and in terms of, you know, the officials helping to run the state party?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's every presidential campaign has done the things that the president's campaign is doing, which is sort of keeping a close eye on the delegate selection process. And frankly, the people who are chosen in that delegate selection process, the people who go to national conventions, usually have gone before. I think the president's campaign is keeping an eye on anomalies in that process. So that has really not changed, I think, prior compared to previous cycles. What has changed, and I think James alluded to this in the previous segment, is the way that the national party is sort of attached itself to the presidential campaign. And that is certainly a relatively new development in American history. Previously, there's sort of been this separation, if not a wink and a nod, between the national party and the nominees campaign. I think what's different and what's driving that is, of course, this, I think the fall of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, the Citizens United case. The campaign and the party believe it is one of the only ways to sort of fight back against the flow of outside money, whether it be by a primary challenger like Governor Weld or from the Democrats. And it gives the campaign a huge financial advantage when it comes to fundraising. Instead of asking for a relatively small figure of money for the campaign, the joint committee can ask for upwards of $1 million per donor. And that gives an incumbent's campaign a huge advantage.
The Citizens United case, which talked about political contributions to certain kinds of entities as free speech. I wanted to ask James Pindle about some of the activities they've seen in state parties, I guess particularly around New England. It seemed to me that from tying together reports and statements from state officials in those states that in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island, I believe in New Hampshire, that the president's campaign has been very active in saying, no, we don't want him or her. We want this one to represent and to lead the state parties.
That's right. One of the most remarkable things we have not talked about enough is how from the 2016 election to today, how Donald Trump has really taken over the Republican Party. It's not just to look at where the rank and file are at the 92-93% approval rating among Republicans for Donald Trump. But tactically, one of the first things he did in office was basically remove the Ohio state Republican chairman, put in place, who was very close with Kasich, and put in place his own person. And then just most recently, just 2 weeks ago, in Rhode Island, as you mentioned, there's a four-way race for state chair. One person looked like they probably were going to get the nod, a solid conservative. Sean Spicer, a native of Rhode Island, was making phone calls on her behalf.
The president's former press secretary.
Correct. And the two-time Republican nominee for governor, including just last fall, supported this person. But you know, the Team Trump campaign found out that that woman supported Carly Fiorina in 2016, and they didn't like that. So they called the person in second place and had her pledge that even though she was not exactly of the base, she's pro-choice, for example, that she would be a full-throated supporter of Donald Trump and help block any particular primary challengers or any drama. And then they flew up, they being Trump campaign staff, flew to Providence to ensure on the actual vote day to whip votes for the woman who eventually did win. This is how much of a granular and how intensely this Trump campaign is taking races like this in the same way with New Hampshire. But we can talk about that more in depth if you'd like. But that's kind of a give us a flavor of where we're at.
And here in Massachusetts as well, where former Weld cabinet secretary Charlie Baker had supported, who's now governor, had supported a candidate, thought he would win, a former state lawmaker, and that candidate lost.
Right. And then there's and the Massachusetts Republican Party reiterated even this morning to me that they will absolutely oppose Bill Weld's run for president and will not use any resources to help him.
I want to take a few calls. Before I do that, I said that Pete McCloskey, who challenged President Nixon in 1972, was from the Midwest. He's from my home state of California. Shame on me. Now, let's take a couple calls. Now from Stevens Point, Wisconsin, Roz is on the line. Roz, what's your thoughts?
Hi. Well, I have a lot of thoughts, but I'll try to limit them.
Okay.
First of all, the fact that the Republican Party is discouraging any kind of opposition to Trump in primaries is distressing to me, mm-hmm. Because I believe other candidates should be looked at, even though probably they don't stand a chance. That's the one thought. But the other thing that I do want to say relative to the huge support for Trump, and I'm an independent, but is all the talk about the economy being so great, and I know numbers look good, but my personal experience, those of my friends, my family, middle class on down, it is not so great as far as what people can expect to own a home. No, not in this day and age. That's very difficult to make happen for the generation coming up. Multiple jobs, both daughters have three, four jobs to try and make ends meet. So all this talk about Trump doing so well with our economy, I don't buy it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, Roz. I want to take a call now from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, always a key state, the first state to vote in the caucuses early next year. Bobbert is calling from Cedar Rapids. Bobbert, go right ahead.
Hi there. Hey, thank you for taking my call. Well, mm-hmm. I'm going to pair it pretty much what the previous caller just said, but we'll add the fact that I believe that The president is driving us to the state of bankruptcy for if that's possible for the government, because he's running our country like he did his businesses with all his bankruptcy. He runs into bankruptcies and then he walks away. And the economy, they say, is so great and wonderful, but it's at a furic cost. It's going to hurt us in the long run. And as an independent here in Iowa, I'm finding that Mr. Weld is going to make a dent. And people are going to be sitting up and listening to him. I know I am.
Thanks, Bobbert, for your call. Appreciate that. The word from Cedar Rapids, at least from that independent. Matt Moore down in South Carolina. The president has a lot of support from fellow Republicans. Obviously, the first hurdle he's got to get over is the primaries, and he's trying to just sew that up from the outset. Is there concern about this sort of broad disparity between his incredible, incredible popularity with the party faithful and the incredibly high historic disapproval ratings he tends to have throughout the more general population?
Yeah, that's a real challenge in swing states next year. You look at states like North Carolina and Georgia, particularly in the South, that are rapidly changing demographically. You compare the current strategies of the senators in those states, Tom Tillis versus David Perdue, and there is some daylight there, right? You see Tom Tillis sort of taking a step back from some things that are controversial, and you see David Perdue often embracing them.
Mm-hmm.
So the rubber will meet the road, I guess, in the fall of next year when we see in these swing states where President Trump, I guess, somewhat surprisingly did well in 2016, if he can do it again.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, James Pindle? Is there any sense that there's is there almost anything – you know, the president once famously boasted he could shoot somebody in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue in New York City near his the Trump Organization headquarters, right? And that nobody would want to convict him because he was so popular. Is it true that certainly on the Republican side there's almost nothing that could come out, no policy controversy, no disclosure in some unredacted form of the Mueller report hand-delivered to each reporter on their doorstep before Election Day 2020 that would derail his support from the Republican party members?
There's two things to answer your question. One is a perception that he is not doing enough on the one thing he's talked about the most, which is building a wall or addressing illegal immigration or undocumented immigration into the country. And I think the second thing, which is what some callers have already addressed, is look, let's just say for no one in the history of the Gallup polling, no president has ever never been above 50% except for Donald Trump. And I think the one thing that's really the one major talking point among Republicans has been the economy. If the economy were to falter, were to crater, again, he would still enjoy significant, huge support among the Republican Party. But they're going to have to concede that point. And remember what we're really talking about here. And we're talking about in terms of his reelection, not the nomination, but the reelection, is we're talking about 78,000 votes in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan that will go the other way. And so if the economy begins to falter, that is the one major talking point of Trump. And that's where I think we would see things start to collapse a little bit. But Trump, the Republicans will still be with him.
Just getting some comments from our website. Kat Berg posts, Republican Party has gone rogue. I would love to see a return to valuing intellectual capacity, moderation, and reasonableness. Case in point, read the comments calling people names. She will vote for former Governor Weld in the primary for sure. Another candidate a listener on Facebook posts, Bill Weld seems to be full of negative things to say about President Trump. I get that. But he's not saying what he will do as far as immigration, the environment, all these other questions that you're asking him. All he's doing is being negative about Trump. I want to hear more positive about what Bill Weld will do. That's from a listener named Andre. Let's take a caller now from Plantsville, Connecticut. Cheryl's on the air. Cheryl, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Cheryl, and I'm calling in regard to Governor Weld. I liked what he said. I didn't think it was negative. I agree with him. I believe it was positive. I've been Republican all my life, and I'm 72 years old. I did not vote for Republicans. I voted for Obama, and I was considering voting Democratic because, along with the other caller, I do believe the Republican Party has gone rogue against a president who is destroying everything we ever believed in. I'm Mary Q. Public, and I've spoken with many Republicans who feel the same way. We're just abhorrent of this president. Environmentally, immigration, taxes, everything he stands for. We feel like he's destroying everything America stands for. Every day, every day talking with other Republicans who just don't believe in the party anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like fear.
It sounds
a
like
fearmonger. That's what Trump is. He's just not. For instance, the saying is he's just not our candidate.
Okay, Cheryl. Well, thank you for that very much. Cheryl calling from Plantsville, Connecticut, says she is Mary Q. Public and a Republican who can't vote for the president. I want to play you a clip from an ad from the conservative group called Defending Democracy Together. It advocates for a third-party challenger to unseat President Donald Trump in 2020.
Remember when Donald Trump said,
"This whole election is being rigged.
Rigged.
A rigged election."
Well, now President Trump's supporters on the Republican National Committee are trying to
rig
the Republican primary system to disadvantage potential GOP challengers. Republican voters should have a choice in 2020. Tell Donald Trump and the RNC not to
rig
the system.
That again, a commercial. It's from a group called Defending Democracy Together. Its directors include such conservatives as the commentators Bill Kristol and Mona Charon. Matt Moore, how much is what you heard from Cheryl a moment ago, from what you've seen from that kind of political group wanting some third party conservative figure to arise? How much does that reflect what you're hearing among, you know, party faithful among Republicans, whether in South Carolina or abroad? Or is that just sort of more a phenomenon of Washington conservatives and Twitter commentators?
I think it's probably more of a latter. Unfortunately, the for those calling, they're probably outliers in the party right now. Every campaign I've worked on the past couple of years, the president's approval is above 90%. So the opening there is very, very small. And then you ask the question of, well, on what issue? And James sort of makes the point about the wall. The people I talk to, with whom I talk, believe the progress is fine on the wall and that the president's not the problem. In fact, they often blame Congress or other factors like this state. But I think I'd also point out, too, that this president's unconventional in so many ways, but the things they are doing, behind the scenes, the blocking and the tackling are not unconventional.
Mm-hmm.
And they will keep doing that. And the party itself was not particularly favorable to President Trump when he came on the scene in sort of mid-2015. And I think back to where the Democratic Party was in 2011, sort of as a student of party history. And the Democratic Party sort of crumbled in the middle of President Obama's two terms and was not particularly helpful as they headed into 2016. So I think the Republican Party is taking a bit longer term of a vision here, doing the unconventional, as frustrating as that is to some activists, and in the hope that it pays off long term.
One of the lessons of this hour, in some ways, Trump often derided as a cavalier and amateur politician, but they're doing some very canny things to try to sew up the path to the renomination. You've been hearing from Matt Moore, partner at the political and grassroots strategy firm First Tuesday Strategies. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
And we've also been talking to James Pindle, a political reporter for the Boston Globe and political analyst for WBUR. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You can continue our conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.